Good morning, everybody. Today is Thursday, I believe. I think it is September 17th, 2015. And this is Before the First Cup of Jewels here on UCY.TV. Happy Thursday, everybody. Almost Friday. One more day. Gets harder and harder every week. Guys, trying to do the show 5 days a week. It is 70 degrees and partly sunny here in upstate New York. It looks like it's going to be another pleasant, almost end of the summer day. So where do we leave off yesterday? Last couple days, we've hit some pretty crazy stuff looking at edible vaccines in GMO food. And so far, we've identified, I believe, 5 foods that they've been manipulating to insert genetically modified vaccines of some kind into and do experiments with. We had the banana was the first experiment, the tomato, then the potato, and yesterday we read about GMO rice and lettuce as well. We also took a look at who good old Bill and Melinda Gates, who are interested in the GMO rice vaccine, and I don't remember who was involved with that lettuce vaccine. That was down at the University of Pennsylvania. But they had been messing with that universal flu vaccine way back when in 2006, utilizing the GMO tobacco. And that's also how they did some of the Ebola vaccines. So put on a seatbelt, people, because we found a bunch of stories out of the National Institute of Health yesterday that appears that this whole newfangled way of doing things is going to be to utilize plants and sneak these vaccines into our food, because people aren't seeming to get with the program, and especially with the Vaccinate All Children Act of 2015 and the Healthy People Act of 2020, and oh, what, the Dark Act, we're not going to label all your food act, so you don't need to know what's in your food, and getting rid of the country of origin labels. They don't need any of us pesky thinkers pointing out the poisons and the dangers and how completely insane some of this stuff is without anything really being tested in the long term. You know, one of the things too that we found interesting, we've been kind of watching these quote unquote outbreaks, and then we saw a couple different instances between the CDC, then we had the DOD, and now we're back to the Department of Defense again with these complete mishandlings of virulent pathogens. At the CDC originally back last summer, they had like smallpox and anthrax, and there might have been a few other things, and there was a whole hearing on Capitol Hill, which I don't remember anything really coming out of that, just like hand slap. Oops, we had smallpox sitting on top of a filing cabinet for 30 years. And then we find out that the DOD had a massive oops. We mentioned this yesterday, and we did a couple whole shows about anthrax, where they'd been shipping anthrax around the globe, and I believe it was 192 different labs that had received this anthrax shipments that were believed to be quote unquote inactivated. And they were doing the inactivation utilizing radiation, but then they discovered, whoops, it didn't kill all the spores. Oh no. So the big thing that they had prepared much of America for back in 2006 after September 11th was, oh, we're going to have terrorist attacks with anthrax, which, knock on wood, never happened en masse, but now we have 192 labs potentially globally that have live anthrax. Well, then what did we find out? We found out now, and this was one that we didn't hit on yet, the other day, September 10th, this was about a week ago, it now comes out that the Pentagon may have mishandled plague bacteria. Well, who would have thunk it? You know, we had a little uptick in plague cases this summer. They even shut down Yosemite National Park to drop flea bombs into the critter holes and try and take care of the problem. Listen to this. CDC is investigating whether deadly organisms, including what? Oh, plague and encephalitis, no big deal, were mishandled or improperly shipped. The Center for Disease Control and Prevention is expanding its investigation into possible mishandling and improper shipment by the Department of Defense laboratories of organisms that cause deadly diseases, including plague and encephalitis, officials said last Thursday. Concerns about handling of those samples led the Army to announce a moratorium on production, shipping, and handling of toxins. Are we, like, literally producing toxins? You know, we've talked about this before, how, quote-unquote, the biowarfare program went away, quote-unquote, in 1972 with the inking of the agreement by Nixon. But it never went away because Nixon said that we were going to continue a defensive posture against biowarfare with the use of vaccines. Well, how amazing is it that we have these agents that pop up every now and then that tend to be an emergency globally? And now it's just so incredible with this fast tracking and this Project BioShield and all this DARPA money sprinkled at universities and private labs worldwide. This, how amazing it is that we have all these new technologies now to flip switches on and off and test which pathogens can kill us and what we can protect against in phase one trials, let's say, and even phase two trials with something like Ebola. And God forbid, they're threatening another pandemic. It might not be as far away as we think. Wink, wink. Then we hear stories like this and we go, oh, how did all the plague get out? It says, when asked why the Pentagon did not disclose the new concerns about plague and encephalitis last week, Pentagon Press Secretary Peter Cook said that officials were trying to be as forthcoming as possible, quote, without alarming the public, unquote. Oh, yes, don't worry about it. That cute little fuzzy squirrel that you're hand-feeding strawberries to didn't have the plague. No, don't worry about it. He added that officials are waiting for the results of the investigation. So we're not going to tell you anything until we find out that, oops, we were wrong. And then we'll spin it in a way that won't get you too concerned. In a statement on Thursday, the CDC said it was investigating four Defense Department labs as a result of spot checks at two facilities. And I'm going to say, if you only did spot checks at two facilities and came up with four issues, you better start. And 192 labs that improperly shipped live anthrax, I think you better do a big ass reassessment. The, you know, this is what gets me. It's like, again, the people that are supposed to be keeping us safe are far from keeping us safe. There is no safety. It is just an illusion of safety. These are the ones that have the most dangerous biowarfare pathogens, and it's like a bunch of drunk idiots walking around bumping into walls. I cannot get over the mismanagement, and I am sure that this is just the very, very, very microscopic tip of the iceberg. In a statement on Thursday, the CDC said it was investigating four Defense Department labs as a result of spot checks at two facilities. The Army said the spot checks were at Englewood Chemical and Biological Center and at the U.S. Army Medical Research Institute of Infectious Diseases, both in Maryland. Quote, the CDC has identified a number of transfers of concern involving multiple organisms, the CDC said. Adding, let's hope the transfers weren't in Ziploc baggies like the CDC with smallpox. Adding that the investigation is trying to determine whether there are record keeping or quality management problems or if there was shipment violations involving the toxin. At this time, there is nothing to suggest risk, of course not, to the health of workers or to the general public. According to the CDC, most of the transfers were between Defense Department facilities, and in a separate statement, the Army said that the CDC raised questions about a particular organism that causes plague known as Yersinia pestis during an August 17th inspection at Englewood. The CDC questioned whether the organism was fully virulent, even though it was stored in an area designated for non-fully virulent material. Cook said that he believes the sample was in a freezer in a controlled setting, but outside of a containment area. How lovely is that? And the CDC questioned whether it was an infectious form of plague. The Army said that initial tests suggest that the strain was not fully virulent, and the CDC is working to verify those tests. In addition, the Army said that the CDC questioned the labeling of a strain of equine, which is a horse, equine encephalitis virus. And I believe, isn't that similar to what struck all those horses in Australia? And then they had to get the genetically modified mosquitoes to go in there and start eating all of the encephalitis mosquitoes so they didn't kill the horses anymore. I thought that was equine encephalitis that hit Australia a few years ago, just, of course, before the genetically modified mosquitoes came in and saved the day. It says, when we asked about the encephalitis sample, Cook said, my understanding is that the way this first came to light was that a CDC spot inspection of this facility, and that the CDC looked at the freezer area where the sample was being held and then checked against the inventory logbook and raised questions about whether or not what was listed on the inventory as non-infectious was, in fact, non-infectious. And that started the testing. Well, shouldn't they be doing that all the time? It says these developments directly contributed to the Army's decision to issue last week a moratorium, a safety review, and an extension of the existing moratorium, thank you, on handling of select agents and toxins. Let's see. Four labs affected by the moratorium are, and this was one of the ones that was responsible for the anthrax shipping everywhere. Good old Dugway Proving Ground. Dugway Proving Ground Life Sciences Testing Facility in Utah. And then three facilities in Maryland. Edgewood Chemical and Biological Center, the U.S. Army Medical Research Institute of Infectious Diseases, and the Navy Medical Research Center. The nine facilities ordered to conduct safety reviews, some of which include the labs undergoing a moratorium, are Dugway, the 7/11th Personnel Wing, Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Ohio, Edgewood Chemical Biological Center in Maryland, the U.S. Naval Medical Research Unit 3 in Egypt. That's not a good place. U.S. Naval Medical Research Unit 6 in Peru, the U.S. Army Soldier Systems Center in Massachusetts, the Naval Medical Research Center in Fort Detrick, Maryland, the Naval Surface Warfare Center in Dahlgren, Virginia, and the U.S. Army Medical Research Institute of Infectious Diseases in Frederick, Maryland. So those are the nine that right now are undergoing reviews. But, hey, don't worry about that, because plague is just so damn rare in this country. We don't ever see cases, right? Oh, but wait. There were a bunch this summer. I believe four people died this summer in the, I don't know if you'd call it the Southwest. I mean, what would you call Yosemite and Colorado? Kind of in the West anyway, generally speaking. And I don't remember where the other cases were, but hold on. I'm trying to find my name while I'm talking. Let's see if we can add me to the call and get something to play today. I did a full reboot of all systems yesterday, so I'm hoping that this fixes the audio issue on clips. All right. So what? Oh, no, we don't have that many cases. We shouldn't be worrying about bubonic plague.
Health officials say that they have confirmed the first ever case of bubonic plague in a Michigan resident. This marks the 14th case of the plague reported in the United States since the beginning of April.
Now, wait a minute. 14 cases since the beginning of April. And yes, this was just 2 days ago. They have reported the first case of bubonic plague ever. Again, never before seen, right? We've had so many of those ever in Michigan. Yeah. So to all of our Michigan listeners, look out and stay away from those little fuzzy squirrels.
Four of those affected have died. Dr. Amar Safdar is an infectious disease specialist from New York University's Langone Medical Center, and he joins us now with more.
Hello.
Doctor, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
You hear bubonic plague, you don't think of something that's happening today.
Sure.
How did this happen?
So, started around 1900s when, there is no bacteria in the New World, in the Americas. So it was brought on with infected rats on the steamships.
It sounds like a fairy tale, doesn't it? We didn't have it in the Americas. It was brought on the steamships, and it very possibly may have been. But I'm sure the Department of Defense had nothing to do with the plague cases that are cropping up all over.
Into the West Coast, various different ports on the West Coast of U.S. And most believe it came from Asia. And then there were outbreaks after outbreaks. So the last outbreak, urban outbreak in U.S. was in L.A. Started in 1924, lasted until the following year, 1925. And since then, the bacteria has found a foothold, and it's endemic now in the western U.S.,
mm-hmm.
mostly in the rodents, mm-hmm. rodents in the wild, chipmunks and what have you. How do one get exposed to it? Usually the fleas from the rodents and the bite from those fleas is how the bacteria gets into someone's system.
Is that pretty much the only way that it can spread? It can't spread like through human contact?
Great. That's a great question. The four cases this summer, a few months ago, that were reported by CDC were from a dog that got sick and died. The two folks in the veterinarian clinic, the person who was the owner of the dog, and another person who was friend of this individual patient.
And we actually listened to clips on that whole case in Colorado, and they're a little afraid that there may have been a person-to-person transmission in this case, by the way.
The plague were exposed. The two people in the veterinarian clinic were exposed from the dog, but his friend has never seen the dog or met the dog. So that was potentially a transmission from this individual whose dog died of what seems like plague, and he developed an unusual form of plague, which hasn't been seen in U.S. since 1924, which is mm-hmm. called pneumonic plague. So it is a pneumonic plague.
That's very concerning.
Well, it's a pneumonic.
Yes, it's very concerning. Again, it's been 80 years or whatever since we've seen it here, and oh, it reappears. And when you start having person, animal to human transmission, and we've talked about this before when we were looking at bird flu and all this other stuff, animal to human transmission and then human to human transmission, those are the makings of a pandemic.
Bubonic plague that actually can be transmitted, but the bubonic plague,
mm-hmm.
which
yep.
is a more common form, 80% or so, does not get transmitted from person to person. There is a lot of concern because it's an older disease, and the black plague that people have read about in their history books sort of stays in mind, and it invokes all sorts of fear.
Absolutely. You have these images in your head.
Sure.
Fear!
You know, in history class.
Certainly. So, back in...
You know, I mean, when you look at, like, pathogens that create fear in the masses, especially over illnesses, and of course, when they have some sort of vaccine that'll cure you, that is the panacea to look toward, right? That's what they want you to do. We had, and I never remember if it was Ebola first or measles. It was measles. Measles came first, and good old Johnny ruined everybody's Disney World vacation. They had parents at each other's throats because mama bears don't mess around. And they started this whole debate, vaccers against anti-vaccers. But then talk about horrifying images. We then had the quote unquote Ebola outbreak and all these potentially dying people with bleeding eyes and orifices. Oh my God. But don't worry about it because we have all of our experimental vaccines in the making to come up with a cure. We're going to do secret serums and tobacco drowned in some sort of RNA solution. And now we have a potential for plague. And when you think of plague, you think of Monty Python, bring out your dead, crunchy black bodies thrown on a death cart somewhere. Yeah, that's doing pretty well at pushing that fear porn button.
In the old days, the death associated with plague was 60% up to 90%. So really a very serious infection. The wonderful thing now is there are several antibiotics that work beautifully against this infection. So now mortality is usually less than and close to about 15%. So it has.
If you get antibiotics within, I thought I read like the first 24 hours or something of symptoms. I mean, you don't have a really big window to get treated for plague, and the symptoms tend to mimic like any other basic illness where you have, you know, feeling malaise and warm and not too good. I mean, you don't realize that it's plague at first, and depending on what version it is, whether it's going to be something that affects your upper respiratory or other, you know, how would you know?
It's come a huge dip down from 90 or 60% down to approaching 15%. The important thing is, How does one prevent getting exposed to it? Well, do not feed and stay away with rodents, even though they look very cute. But do
no,
not,
they're not very cute in New York.
Do not get exposed to them. And certainly do not.
Yes, no playing with the subway rats in New York City.
Feed them. And do not handle if one comes across during hikes and what have you, or camping, a dead or sick appearing rodent.
They have a map up right now, and so they're showing the 2015 plague cases have occurred in Colorado, New Mexico, Arizona, Utah, California, Oregon, Georgia, and Michigan. So that is 4, 6, 8 states so far. Since April, by the way, of 2015.
The other thing is, it seems to be difficult to diagnose it because unless you have your suspicion high enough, it could mimic several other infections. Well, except when it presents with huge, tender lymph nodes, which are really grotesque, large lymph nodes. That's why bubonic plague. Those are difficult to miss. And then it should be in any physician's differential when someone presents, especially in the Western U.S.
All right. Well, Olive, unfortunately, we've got to get going because of time. But the bottom line here is, even if you're an animal lover, just stay away from those rodents.
And one other thing, there are only 14 cases so far this year.
Yes.
There were 17 cases reported in 2006.
Oh.
Still, there were 10 cases. And the year before, only 4. So it does go up and down. So I don't think there is any reason to get alarmed that suddenly we have doubling of cases, because it does go up and down. And there are several reasons why this happens.
All right. No need to panic.
Do not panic.
All right. Dr. Amar Safdar, thank you for your expertise.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Okay. So make sure you do not panic. It does go up and down. The cases have doubled, but hey, don't worry about it. But did you notice that nobody mentioned the story from the week before about the Pentagon now having 4 different labs under investigation for improper handling of things such as what? Oh, yes, plague. Don't worry about it. And didn't the Pentagon say that they didn't really release a lot of information in the beginning because they didn't want people to panic? No, they like things to percolate for a while. And then, if need be, they can declare some sort of emergency because, you know, they have all these vaccines waiting in the wings. We looked at yesterday, and I'm going to go back to the show yesterday and just look at a couple of these story titles. We had the banana vaccine, we had the tomato, the potato, the rice, and the lettuce vaccines that they are working on. They were also working on the tobacco vaccine. We also found out how much easier it was for them to get the medication or whatever they're putting into these vaccines, the ones in particular that we were looking at were using DNA switch flipping, how much easier it was to get it into the body through the mucosal lining of the intestines. It's encapsulated in your food, gets through your digestive system, and then it is absorbed directly into the bloodstream through your intestine. And of course, then when we took a look at some of the connections between the brain and the gut microbiome, which is something that they were looking at manipulating, we saw some horrifying future consequences. Now, we had listened to, actually, I don't think we got it to play yesterday. There was an interview from Dr. Mercola with Vicki Diebold, who is a PhD nurse who was in charge of all kinds of different things. And she was talking about genetically modified vaccines. And I put some of that into the show yesterday after the fact, after I had all those technical issues, to air at 5 o'clock. But what I wanted to play for you was the second half of this interview, where she actually starts he asks her, Dr. Mercola asks her about edible vaccines. So hold on 1 second here. Let me connect back up. All right, so here, let's check this out.
I think the use of foreign DNA in various forms has the potential to cause a great deal of trouble, not only because if there is the potential for it to recombine with our own DNA, there is the potential for it to turn the DNA switches, the epigenetic parts of the DNA, on and off. So I think that we're still in a place where there's a lot of work that needs to be done to figure out what the short and long-term effects of this type of DNA are on people who have lots of different genetic makeups.
I'm going to pause here for a second. Basically, what she's saying, and she's absolutely correct, and this is what we've been saying all along, with all this newfangled mad science gone mad technology, and this doesn't only include these new RNA vaccines or using these genetically modified plants to express antigens that then we're going to sneak into food in through your gut, but also let's just go back to plain old basic genetically modified, where we're splicing in genes. There is no long-term research generationally to show how this is going to potentially affect future generations. And we talked yesterday too about researcher out of Stanford. I looked up where she was from. The woman had been looking at just using the fetal stem cells in the original vaccines, that line that was from like the 60s, I believe, that still exists in the MMR. And she had been finding that fragments of that human DNA were attaching to the DNA of the people who received those vaccines, and there was a huge potential for autistic-like characteristics. So anyway, let's get back here. So they have run fast forward with putting all these mad science vaccines on the market, and I think she talks about that here. There already are some that are in progress being used today. Gardasil was one with those virus-like particles, and I think she said there was another one.
Maybe if we could just expand on your concern for a bit with this recombination of the genetic material and help us understand how that would work. So you've got this edible vaccine, for instance, that is some type of plant material typically that's grown with the new introduced engineered vaccine component. So, and that typically is a strand of DNA or some nucleotide sequences that represent the antigen they're trying to build a response to. So how is this combination going to occur? I mean, what's your concern? And I just want to have everyone understand a little better.
Okay, well, this is one of the delivery technologies that are being explored, the new using vaccines orally, meaning what you eat and ingest, and that would involve putting hybridized or somehow modified DNA for pathogenic virus or bacteria into food that's eaten, and then it would be ingested and then incorporated somehow in to the bloodstream so that the immune system reacts to it. There are other ways of introducing genetically modified vaccines that we need to be aware of as well. Besides the standard injections, there are nasal routes, squirting vaccines up the nose. And then there are the transdermal routes that I think are very important because they involve use of nanotechnology, which would permit introduction of DNA directly into our cells. Genetically engineered vaccines are already being used. Beginning in 1991, the hepatitis B vaccine was licensed and is given to infants beginning on the first day of life. It is considered a genetically engineered vaccine. It's a recombinant vaccine where parts of the hepatitis B virus are recombined with yeast. This is one of several vaccines that are already being given to infants and teenagers and are part of the CDC's recommended vaccination schedule.
Are there any recommendations you have for the person watching this with respect to how they might make an impact on this type of movement progressing much further, the introduction of genetically engineered vaccines?
Well, I think it's incumbent upon everyone, as usual, to be educated, to read and find out which vaccines are genetically engineered and what they're not.
Don't listen to your stupid doctor pumping you full of propaganda, telling you that you're a tinfoil hat wearing lunatic and that this is the way it's always been.
And to demand of the scientific and government communities that they do the type of safety testing that we need in order to make informed decisions, be involved, understand what's going on, understand what can be done in terms of asking for better evidence of safety and effectiveness. One of the best ways to be involved is to go to nvic.org and sign up for the advocacy portal, where we are actively working on a number of vaccine issues, and genetically engineered vaccines are part of the topics that we're trying to stay on top of as states begin to make changes to their laws. All over the country, the right to choose and to exercise legal exemptions to vaccination is being challenged in state legislatures. And it's really important that people be educated and aware of how the laws are changing, what that means for being able to give informed consent. And the genetically engineered piece of it is critical. It's very critical that people understand how the laws related to not just genetically engineered vaccines, but genetically modified foods of all sorts have the potential to affect human health in ways that we absolutely do not understand at this point.
How awesome was that? And that is everything that we've been saying. It's so insane because as the push for mandatory vaccination gets closer and closer, and you know, in a bunch of the states, of course, they've been getting rid of exemptions, religious and what do they call it, conscientious objector-esque. They're working on a federal mandate to make it mandatory for not only all children, but the Healthy 2020 People Act would be for adults as well. Right now, it's a standing order to recommend that all adults get their boosters, but eventually, don't think that they're not going to pull the card going, well, you're a danger, Johnny, because, you know, you're not in with the herd. And this isn't going to be across the board because it absolutely will be. And as they get rid of labeling laws and they get rid of country of origin laws and they get rid of any liabilities for the vaccine companies and they pass bills such as the Project BioShield, all they got to do is declare a state of emergency and that opens the floodgates to all of these experimental vaccines that have been sitting in the wings waiting for human trials. But it's not ethical to trial that stuff on humans yet unless there's an emergency. There is absolutely some scary writing on the wall, and she is right with these genetically modified vaccines. So what we've seen is that they're splicing and dicing DNA from different creatures, and they're putting in nanotechnology. She had talked about three routes for ingestion. One is the edible vaccine. That is through the mucosa of the small intestine. The second one we had talked about a long time ago, and that is the intranasal vaccine. And we had seen a story a few weeks ago that it talked about the easiest and the best way to get nanotechnology in particular across the blood-brain barrier. And one of those ways was up the nose. And the third way was transdermally. That seems to be a really good way to get nanotechnology into the body. Well, check this out. A story came out yesterday out of phys.org. Targeted drug delivery with these nanoparticles can make medicines more effective. Yes. And I mean, they've been doing this for a while, and we've been talking about this for a while, but this has become reality. I did not know about the Hep B vaccine. And what's interesting with her mentioning the Hep B vaccine being one of these newfangled mad science vaccines is that that was with that original doctor, I don't remember his name, Artson maybe, the one that had been experimenting on the vaccine banana. That was one of the things that he had talked about. All right, here, let me read this. Nanoparticles disguised as human platelets could greatly enhance the healing power of drug treatments for cardiovascular disease and systemic bacterial infections. And these platelet-mimicking nanoparticles developed by engineers at the University of California, San Diego, are capable of delivering drugs to targeted sites in the body, particularly injured blood vessels, as well as organs infected by harmful bacteria. Yes, these are platelet mimicking nanoparticles. Now, what did we learn that these mad scientists figured out a long time ago is mimicking nature is the best way for them to come in under the sheep's clothing and then become the wolf once they get inside. That's exactly. Nature figured it out millions of years ago, and a lot of these mini robotics, mini drones, the robo bees and the hummingbird drones, they're all mimicking nature, trying to get a bipedal robot. They mimicked nature to get the correct dimensions, and that seems to be the key to all of this. Copycat nature, sneak in the back door and you're in. Engineers demonstrated that by delivering the drugs just to the areas where drugs are needed, these platelet copycats, there we go, greatly increased the therapeutic effect of drugs that were administered to diseased rats and mice. The research led by nano engineers at UC San Diego Jacobs School of Engineering was published online September 16th, yesterday, in Nature. Quote, "This work addresses a major challenge in the field of nanomedicine, targeted drug delivery with nanoparticles," says Lefxiang Zhang, a nanoengineering professor at UC San Diego and a senior author of the study. "Because of their targeting ability, platelet-mimicking nanoparticles can directly provide a much higher dose of medication specifically to diseased areas without saturating the entire body with drugs." The study is an excellent example of using engineering principles and technology, yes, to achieve what? Oh, keyword, ding, ding, precision medicine. And, of course, Obama has his National Precision Medicine Initiative here in the United States. So this is the way it's going to be, people. This is the future of medicine. This bioeconomy is moving in fast forward. And if we, I'm telling you, I don't think people understand exactly what they're doing right now. And like that nurse said, and I never remember her name, if I can get back there, Vicky Diebold. You know, this is important for informed consent, because you might be consenting to a vaccine. You're consenting to immunological properties that maybe you understand in a very haphazard way in your brain. But for proper consent. Don't you need to understand the entire process that's going on inside the body? And I think if people actually understood that these are not like old school immunotherapy vaccines, these are mad science gone mad, mimicking nature, slipping in a Trojan horse into the body and trying to make the body do what we want it to do, untested generationally in humans. The people would stand up and say, screw this. I'm not putting this into my kid. And when you think about, too, that Hep B vaccine, that's something that goes into infants. And that's already a GMO vaccine. They give that like day one when the kid is born. They make you, we looked at that the other day, they make you ink a paper when you're all hallucinating and drugged up or in labor in the hospital. But there's no informed consent there. Nobody is explaining to me nanotechnology or DNA, RNA, switch flipping. There's no informed consent. Anyway, to finish the story, while the proof of principle study demonstrates specific delivery therapeutic agents to treat cardiovascular disease and bacterial infections, it also has broad implications for targeted therapy for other diseases such what? Oh, cancer and neurological disorders. And that's actually a great place to hop off, because speaking of neurological disorders, we read a couple stories last week of them being able to diagnose mental disease. And one of the ways that they could do it was through voice patterns. They could run your voice through an application and tell whether or not you were going to have a probability of mental disease in your future. And then, hey, they had treatments for neurological disorders. And the way they found the best to get the drugs into the brain was up through the nose. Well, wait until you hear this. Hold on. There was an executive order passed 2 days ago. Good old Obama is at it again. It is titled on whitehouse.gov, Using Behavioral Science Insights to Better Serve the American People. Yes, using behavioral science insights to better serve the American people. A growing body of evidence demonstrates that behavioral science insights, which is research findings from fields such as behavioral economics and psychology, ding, 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 about how people make decisions and act on them, can be used to design government policies to better serve the American people. Now, if you read through this executive order, and I'm not going to scroll all the way down through this and read this bullshit because it's just such a bunch of drivel. They make it that they're going to do like focus studies. Oh, how easy was this website to use? And oh, how difficult was it for you to go stand in the welfare line? And oh, how hard was it for you to call the IRS and get an answer on your tax return? Oh, we're going to make an improvement plan now and better serve the American people by your feedback. That's how they're spinning this. But remember, Edward Bernays, everything goes back to the fall of Western civilization, to Edward Bernays, where they learned to use propaganda to manipulate the minds, hearts, and wallets of the American people. And it's not just the American people, but at that time, they were targeting the American people. And with the passage of NDAA of 2013, and I found that document one day, and I found the segment. They did authorize the use of propaganda that up until that point, legally, quote unquote, was only allowed to be used via the State Department for countries external to the United States to spread Americana worldwide. Well, as of the NDAA 2013, it then became, quote unquote, legal to utilize those same propaganda techniques on the American people. So how interesting is that? That's why we can't trust any news. That's why there is no journalism happening in the mainstream. That's why healthy vaccine doctors, ones who are talking out against the system, are ending up dead in oodles. It's because it's going against now the crafted paradigm that they're working so hard to Kraft and those pesky truthers, the 9/11 people, the anti-vaxxer people, the anti-GMO people, the anti-war people, the anti-Obama people. Every single one of us is putting a thorn. It's a death by a thousand cuts. And Hillary Clinton came out and said it, that they are losing the information war. So you know what? Screw this shit. Obama says, let's get some behavioral scientists. Let's get some psychologists on board to help us better craft our message to dupe the American people even better than we already are, because there seem to be people out there that are immune to our magic. And what concerns me, what really concerns me, and we touched on this briefly yesterday, is with these edible vaccines, which I did not know about, something that I completely missed along the way, and heard April and Verstein mentioning in an interview when I was cutting their show up, and said, huh, you know, it's the second time I've heard about edible vaccines, and looked into it, was very shocked. But with all we know about GMO foods, about vaccines, about RNAi, about nanotechnology, and listening to Eric Drexler with the desktop manufacturing facilities and the, you know, cures for cancer with self-replicating nanorobots that take medicine exactly to where it's supposed to go, which we just read about. We also read yesterday a story that came out of DARPA about DARPA's, now their whole plan with using these newfangled mad science vaccines to prompt the body into becoming its own bioreactor. They push some buttons and your body starts producing stuff. You know, how long is it going to be now that they're trying to crack the microbiome and figure out how the gut and the brain talk to each other? We know that we have this whole national and international project called the Brain Project. But here in the United States, we have a lot of the big technical companies involved, including Google. Remember, good old love to hate them, Ray Kurzweil, head of engineering. We got Motorola involved. We got Microsoft, Billy Gates involved. National Institute of Health and all of the lizard dens of universities that have sprinkled funding, all these biopharma companies, all these new startup biopharma companies that are spinning out of universities, again with DARPA dollars. When you look at all of this together, you look at some of DARPA's research on how to push buttons now. This is this new project for wounded warriors and for, what were they calling them, super soldiers on the battlefield, right? Because that's where DARPA's research is supposed to go, is to the military. They discovered that they can easily push buttons and cause your brain to produce chemicals that will give them the desired effect. They showed it in the rats. They had these wireless push-button things embedded in their brains. They got the new DARPA chip. Guys, this is not science fiction. It's already happening in the lab. And how long is it going to be before they understand how the microbiome fully interoperates with your brain, that they could slip anything into your food? And tomorrow, you're not going to feel like being a radical anymore. There didn't they at one point, there was a video that went around, it looked like somebody had recorded it from a private briefing on this radical gene, and they were going to have this love bomb or something that they dropped from the sky on the Middle East that would get radical religious fundamentalists to not be radically religious fundamentally anymore. It totally mellowed them out and got them to kind of forget all their angst. And, you know, when they're now that they're researching the brain chemicals in depth, and we found out about dopamine. Dopamine, we dug into deep, and that is the dangling carrot. They use that right now to influence us to do so many things, and it all goes back to Bernays. You know, it's why we're addicted to our cell phones. It's why we're addicted to video games, to television, to fatty foods and high fructose corn syrup, to sex and money. It's all about the dopamine rush. Well, all they got to do is to figure out what chemical is going to make us non-combative and flip a couple switches. And guess what? We will be disabled. And I mean, I know I'm just postulating, but you know that's what they're working on. Behavioral Science Insights to Better Serve the American People. Executive Order, September 15th, 2015. Part of the directive, the executive departments and agencies are encouraged to, one, identify policies, programs, and operations where applying behavioral science insights may yield substantial improvements in public welfare, yes, program outcomes, and program cost effectiveness. Well, hey, public welfare and program outcomes, let's make sure that nobody gets bubonic plague. Hey, we just came out with some new vaccine. Flipping a few switches to turn your body into a bioreactor so you never have to worry about bubonic plague again. Well, all we got to do is get everyone to eat this apple. And our program outcome and the cost, we found it's only a dollar or two a dose, will be in line. Oh, but wait, if we get rid of the labeling on everything, then no one will know they're eating it. Yeah, they did that already. Whoops. Number two, develop strategies for applying behavioral science insights to programs and, where possible, rigorously test and evaluate the impact of these insights. I bet they're going to go to work with Facebook and some of their sociology and psychology research that they're doing on social media right now, live, real time, with live participants. A lot of the sociology and psychology departments and colleges are already using Facebook as a study tool. Number three, and Google as well. Number three, recruit behavioral science experts. Yes, recruit behavioral science experts to join the federal government as necessary to achieve the goals of this directive. And you know, Google is also, they have the ability to open up the microphone, right? We've talked about that. We've heard about that, them being able to advertise. It was part of a patent. By opening the microphone on your computer and you're talking about, you know, getting a couch and all of a sudden ads for couches pop up. You talk about shampoo and there's shampoo ads. How did that happen? You think that maybe it's scraping your email or maybe your searches, but then people have come out and said, but wait, I didn't search that or that wasn't in my email. But yes, we know that they also use live audio. Well, now that they have an application that can diagnose mental disease via audio voice print, how long is it going to be before the feds hop into bed with Google, which they already are, but I'm saying like making those audio files, put them in a database, run an algorithm with red buttons to then give to DARPA Dan for his X project where they can put all the insurgents on a big touchscreen table map and disable them. They will target you. You know my brain starts spinning when I start reading about this technology, and I was in technology for 25 adult years of my life. And one of the things that I was always good at was connecting the dots and seeing the future. So this isn't the future that we wanted. This is not, there's no informed consent with what is happening here. There's nobody that is voting for this. This is robo-pen galore, executive orders up the ass, and congressmen who are rubber stamping, passing bills that are funded by lobbyists. Our FDA, our USDA are rubber stamping everything because remember, a vaccine is a vaccine. Apparently, a banana is a banana, an apple is an apple, a potato is a potato, a carrot is a carrot, and nobody's minding the store. So this story about the executive order, which was the executive order, that came from JJ, so give him a big thumbs up. And because that story went up, SLC Mike dropped me a story at the end of the afternoon yesterday in Decision Science News. Yes. We're hiring a behavioral insight team for the United States. Some recent good news is that the United States has created a similar team to the UK's behavioral insight team. And what's more, they are hiring. The team is led by the impressive Maya Ushankar, senior policy advisor, who is a PhD psychologist and a Rhodes Scholar. Ding, ding. We just chatted with Maya and feel that this team is poised to do great things. Here's the overview. A growing body of evidence suggests that insights from the social and behavioral sciences can be used to help design public policies that work better, cost less, and help people to achieve their goals. The practice using behavioral insights to inform policy has been seen as successes overseas. In 2010, UK Prime Minister David Cameron commissioned the Behavioral Insights Team, which through a process of a rapid, iterative experiment, test, learn, adapt, has successfully identified and tested interventions. Yes, we will be intervened with that will further advance properties of the British government while saving the government at least £1 billion over the next 5 years. The federal government is currently creating a new team that will help build federal capacity to experiment with these approaches and to scale behavioral interventions that have been rigorously evaluated using, where possible, randomized controlled trials. Yes, you won't know you're part of it. The team will be staffed by 4 or 5 experts in behavioral science and experimentation design and evaluation. Oh, my God. And it is likely that selected individuals will serve on a temporary detail under the Intergovernmental Personnel Act before returning to their home organization, which can be a university, a nonprofit, or state or local government. Our preference is for individuals who are willing to serve full-time, but we will also consider people who are in a position to serve part-time. Moreover, several agencies are looking to recruit expert academics to sit directly within their agencies and to help inspire, design, and execute on specific project policy, and so it is possible to serve in this capacity as well. If you are aware of an individual with strong analytic skills, experience designing, testing, and evaluating rigorous randomized control trials, and strong research background in a field such as social psychology, cognitive psychology, behavioral economics, please encourage them to send their resume and contact information to that Shankar lady, which will be sent to relevant parties. How great is this? We are going to have a psychology team helping the federal government craft messages and programs just for you and me. All right, people, if you can even believe it, another hour has gone by. We are going to have to continue with this tomorrow. Thank you very much for that story, SLC. Make sure you stick around. Kevin Blanche is next. Behind the Woodshed with Hal. Game On with Ron at 7. Double Cross with Chuck at 10. And Anti Media, that's at 11. Everyone have an awesome Thursday. And I will catch you. Oh!